This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. A new shelter has opened up for LGBTQ youth in Indianapolis, and it's the first one in the state. Trinity Haven is a residential facility for LGBTQ youth and young adults who are at risk of homelessness. And with us today is Jenny White, the executive director of the facility, to tell us more about it. We're also talking with Chris Paulson, CEO of Indiana Youth Group, about the various efforts being done to ensure LGBTQ youth have the resources they need. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jenny, I want to start with you and talk about Trinity Haven. Why was this shelter necessary?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question, Miriam. Thank you so much. So several years ago, Trinity Episcopal Church was discerning what to do with a piece of property on their campus. And they were meeting with several nonprofits in the community to determine how best to utilize that space. And that is when they learned through a conversation with folks at IYG about this need for housing for LGBTQ youth who are experiencing homelessness at alarming rates. And through a series of conversations that led to plans and dreams, Trinity Haven was born through an incubation process, if you will, of Trinity Episcopal Church. They have a rich history of incubating nonprofits, giving them the space to get started, and then setting them free to do great work in the community. So Trinity Haven was created by those amazing people here in our community. And now we are our own nonprofit organization. We are not a faith-based entity. We are standing on our own with the support of several faith-based organizations, including the members of Trinity Episcopal Church, who are right by our side, knowing that this need in our community is so prevalent. Up to 40% of youth who are experiencing homelessness are LGBTQ folks. And they're, again, showing up in alarming rates. And also, I will say, you know, the data isn't super conclusive either, because young people are really, really great at finding the resources they need to stay alive and survive, and to not actually get checked in a box in a system that exists. And that's not unique to Indianapolis. That's across the country. Mm-hmm. And so they are resourceful, incredible human beings. And when those resources run out, they we know that they're in a place of needing that sort of safe, affirming space because they've really depleted everything else that's available to them. And so that is the shortest version I can come up with for how Trinity Haven came to be, which is pretty incredible journey that we've been on.
Right. I mean, I can tell you're very enthusiastic about it. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I do want to ask, Chris, before we get into numbers and all that, because I definitely want to touch on that. You collaborate with so many folks and organizations, Trinity Haven being one of them. What did you think about this project when it was first launched?
We saw a huge need in the community at the time. There was no housing support for LGBTQ youth experiencing homelessness, and actually none for any youth experiencing homelessness in Indianapolis. Like Jenny said, 40% of youth experiencing homelessness are LGBTQ, way overrepresented in the population. One in four youth, when they come out in Indiana, are thrown out of their home. That's a very sad statistic, but very real. So when Trinity Episcopal came up with this idea, we were all for it. And since, there's been a lot of other organizations that have seen the need. So right now there are seven organizations working under the Youth Homeless Demonstration Project to address youth homelessness in Indianapolis. And I think, although our programs have only been up and running about 8 months now, we're really making a big difference as a collaborative group in youth homelessness. Mm-hmm. I would estimate we've probably housed close to 50 youth now in 6 or 7 months. So that's taking a dent out of it. It's definitely not the majority of youth experiencing homelessness, but it's a great start. And I think we're building a really strong foundation where we will be able to end youth homelessness in Indianapolis at some point.
Mm-hmm. And this is the first shelter in the state for youth homelessness, or is it specifically for LGBTQ youth, Jenny?
Well, I would love to clarify that for you. So it's not really a shelter. Transitional living is meant to be long-term. And so we offer up to 24 months of housing support here in our transitional living program. And there is an application process. And so it's not a shelter in the traditional term. And folks who understand how the homelessness intervention systems work, typically an emergency shelter is a place someone can show up and get a bed that night and be able to sleep soundly. And so I want to just really be clear for our listeners that that is not the situation here. We only have 8 spaces here in the transitional living program, and 4 are already claimed. The other 4 are in various states of the application process. And so we know that we will be full within the next couple of weeks. And if every young person stays for up to 2 years, then it's unfair of us to manage any sort of wait list, because waiting for 2 years is unreasonable for any young person, for any person in the span of their life. And so we're so grateful to be working with the Youth Homelessness Demonstration Project and all of our partners here in Indianapolis to help have those as a referral source for any other young person who is experiencing homelessness. Trinity Haven was created specifically for the LGBTQ community. We do not discriminate, however. And so if there is a young person who is in need and this specific intervention is the right fit for them, then we would definitely explore what that looks like. But it was created with LGBTQ folks in mind, because that need is ever present. And as you mentioned, there is not a single facility, right? A standalone place that has a housing option specifically for LGBTQ youth.
Right. And I know both of you mentioned the numbers are high for LGBTQ youth to face homelessness. So Chris, are there any other resources? I mean, it just seems like there isn't enough.
There isn't enough in any system that addresses homelessness. And that's, you know, the battle we fight in this work every day. But there are more and more resources for young adults facing homelessness. We have a diversion program now that helps those young people avoid the system. You know, that's the best thing we can do, is help people avoid homelessness. So the diversion program works with them. We have a program called YouthLink that helps young adults navigate the system. You know, social service systems are difficult. They're difficult as an adult with access to the internet and a phone and money. When you're a youth and have none of that, it's almost impossible to navigate. So there are peer navigators that help these young people navigate the systems to help them figure out which program is best for them and where are they going to thrive the best and the strongest and the fastest to get back on their feet and to become, you know, adults who are contributing to Indianapolis, which is what we all want to see.
Mm-hmm. And Jenny, what's the response been from the community? I know you mentioned you already have 4 or 5 spots full, or maybe you said 4. Is it like getting a lot of steam, a lot of notice?
It has, actually. It's really, really such a blessing, having been working on this project. I've been on board for just over 2 years, and I know that since its inception, it's been a little over 4 years. And so the ramp up to creating Trinity Haven has really been a wonderful thing. And at the same time, it's been challenging, right, to not come online until just now. So when we held our ribbon cutting ceremony on April 30th, it was exciting to announce to our front yard full of our constituents and funders and supporters that the house itself was open, and that we're also launching our host homes program, which is a short-term housing intervention meant to provide housing for up to 6 months, matching a young person in need to a community member who is willing to open their heart and their home to that young person to give them some stability while they work very closely with our youth engagement specialist in navigating what their next steps are towards permanent housing they can sustain and afford, or supportive housing if they need that for a certain amount of time, whether that's a space here at Trinity Haven's Transitional Living Program or in any of the other housing intervention options that Chris mentioned. There are 6 or 7 other agencies here in the city that are providing housing specifically for youth, including IYG and the Damien Center. I'm going to lose my wording here, but there are several of us who are doing housing intervention across what's called the continuum of care for young people. And so Host Homes provides a short-term 6-month intervention. The transitional living program is up to 24 months. And then we have other programs of varying degrees of permanent housing, where the young person actually signs a lease, and some or most of their rent is paid for through this grant that we've been afforded by the Youth Homelessness Demonstration Project, which is a division of HUD. And then by working with different case managers throughout their journey, are able to become more and more self-sufficient and less reliant on those grant funds to pay their rent and utilities. And mm-hmm. so it's a journey, it's a process to get folks from being unstable and unhoused to having housing, and then the journey towards them sustaining it and affording it completely 100% on their own. That's right. A process for sure.
Right. But it sounds like there's a lot of things kind of coming together, and perhaps this will become a model in the future for other cities or parts of Indiana.
Oh, we certainly hope so. That was definitely part of the original strategic plan of the organization here at Trinity Haven, was that our program could be replicated or duplicated either by us or any other organization or group of people who are willing to take that leap of faith in a way and create an affirming space for LGBTQ youth. Mm-hmm. So we're looking forward to revisiting that strategic plan and how we can help be a model for transitional living programs specifically for this population. And we're just grateful to be part of that continuum, because there, every one of those housing interventions is unique and different. And it offers that the young people who are in need a choice. Mm-hmm. They have a choice of what they need most in their life. And we are hoping to provide as many choices and options as possible. And being able to explain those in forums like this is really wonderful. So thank you for having us here today.
Well, thank you for joining us. And Chris, as we get ready to wrap up here real quick, what are some resources, or are there any phone numbers that folks can contact if they're in need of help?
Yes, the best place, I think, is to reach out to YouthLink, and that number is 317-699-1994, and that will connect the youth to a peer navigator who can help them figure out, like Jenny said, what is best for them, and that is a youth choice. The youth decides where they best fit into the system. So that's the best entry point, and then from there, different housing programs offer different supports and different lengths of stays and things like that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today. Jenny White, Executive Director, Trinity Haven, and Chris Paulson, CEO of Indiana Youth Group. Coming up, how do you engage in difficult conversations with friends and family members, whether it's about your COVID-19 boundaries or topics that might make you feel uncomfortable? We'll learn more about why these conversations aren't that easy to have and how to have them after a quick break. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Difficult conversations. We've all had them, or maybe we've tried to avoid them. With so many unknowns these days in the midst of a pandemic, a lot of friends and family members may feel more divided. And that's when these difficult conversations come into play. For example, if you choose to be vaccinated and someone you care about doesn't think it's important, how do you let them know that it's not okay for them to be around your unvaccinated children? That's just one scenario. There are so many other situations that warrant a discussion, but it's not always easy to do. With us now is Catherine Borchuk, Professor of Psychology at Indiana University, South Bend. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I want to just dive right in here. Why is it so hard for us to communicate with each other on sensitive topics? And why does it feel like we're walking on eggshells all the time?
We often do feel like we're walking on eggshells, don't we, Miriam? Thanks for opening up this conversation. It's so important today to talk about these kinds of things, the things that we're not talking about, in fact, COVID being one of them. You know, I just had the opportunity a little while ago to say to somebody that calling somebody out, from my professional opinion, is probably not the best way to affect behavior change. So I think that we many times just don't have the skills to be able to tell people what we're comfortable with, what we're interested in seeing. Instead, we call somebody out, we blame them, we point fingers, and mm-hmm. that's not the way to get somebody to change their behavior. That's the way to make people feel defensive. And I think sometimes we just back away altogether because we kind of intimate somebody might get defensive. We've seen actually violence happening, even, you know, violent incidents happening on social media from different parts of the country over things like mask wearing, over things like social distancing and people gathering. And I think that certainly is going to keep some folks hesitant from speaking out. But there are certainly more effective ways to communicate what your wants and needs are without pointing fingers and blaming someone and putting them into a posture where they kind of feel defensive.
Right, right. And I think this COVID situation has put many of us in this position maybe we've never been in before, where everybody got along pretty much. You all felt like you were on the same page. But this, for some reason, has caused such a divide where it's like you're on one side or the other. You're either with science or against science. And it's just very interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I agree that we're all getting along prior to COVID. I think, in fact, it's possible.
Maybe not perfectly.
I think divisiveness is, in fact, part of the problem right now. Mm-hmm. Here, there are more than one realities. There are multiple realities that people are living within. If you take a deep dive into some of the science deniers on the internet, and I've taken a little look here, you really see alternate facts, alternate facts, alternate points of view, alternate data, even, you know, the rogue studies here and there, the ones that don't have any credence for people not trained in a scientific background. They're not really aware that these, you know, alt studies are not really science. So I mm-hmm. think the fact that we started off quite divided, maybe politically, but also culturally, fed into our divisiveness over COVID. COVID became politicized because of the strife and the divisions that I think existed already. That's my feeling of how COVID became such a touch point, such a hot spot for people. Mm-hmm.
And when we talk more broadly about just the comfort level of people talking about difficult or sensitive topics, I find it interesting in some aspects because American culture is perceived as very liberal outside of the U.S. But we're also timid, though, at the same time when it comes to talking about things like racism or COVID-19 boundaries or finances. So what is it about, I'm just wondering, about our culture that seems mm-hmm. out there to everybody else, like, wow, they're so liberal. But then when it comes to getting real, it's just so much harder.
It is funny. I mean, the stereotype of Americans is that we're all on a talk show bearing our secrets to everybody all the time, right? But in fact, we're not a culture. We're a whole mix of lots of different cultures, and different cultures have different customs about what is permissible to talk about. I mean, in so many cultures, you don't talk about death, you don't talk about money, you don't talk mm-hmm. about sex. When I teach students how to do research and ask questions, I let them know that no matter who you're talking to, there are folks who are not going to want to talk about some topics. There's just this social desirability that either it's not polite to mention, we don't talk about this, it's impolite, or perhaps it's asking too much of the person that you're talking to actually bring up these topics. How did COVID become one of these? I mean, it's a public health thing. It's like measles. Why is this so tricky to talk about? And I think that goes back to the underlying and longstanding divisions that we have had, because one's belief in mask wearing, one's beliefs in vaccination seem now to be almost a proxy for a political position, a political belief. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's become a little bit touchy as well. But some customs, you know, there are, when we say we don't like to talk about race in this country, that's usually white people who don't like to talk about race. That's not everybody who doesn't want to talk about race. And certainly, I asked some students recently if they'd been vaccinated, and a student said to me, "Everybody I know has been vaccinated." And then she kind of whispered, she said, "But I'm a science student," as though acknowledging that there are different kinds of people in the world and not everybody thinks like me. And she was kind of really, you know, quiet about saying that, as though that particular identity meant something to her and she didn't want to share it too much, that it mm-hmm. represented something.
Well, when we talk about things like racism, I'm thinking about just these difficult conversations that people are having in the last year or so during COVID mm-hmm. lockdown, really reflecting. It can be hard to address family members or friends because there's often a relationship there where you care about someone and you want them to understand maybe what they're saying or doing is wrong, but you're nervous about how to approach it. What Absolutely. Creates this sort of uncomfortable feeling, and how can it be overcome?
Yeah, I would say that race is probably one of the trickiest things to have a conversation about in the United States. And we're not just talking about, you know, our friends and the people we work with who might be a multiracial or multicultural group, but even just, you know, your great aunt on Facebook kind of mm-hmm. thing. Those conversations are difficult as well. Let me go back to what I said, that I believe that racial conversations are more difficult for white people. White folks get very defensive. There's been lots of books written about this lately, about this topic, about white fragility, for instance, about right. white innocence, racial innocence. It wasn't me. I didn't do anything bad. Don't blame me. I don't want to feel that defensiveness. I don't want to feel that responsibility. Therefore, I can't talk about white privilege, for instance. It takes an awful lot of educating. And sort of gentle education, I find, because I do teach about racism and prejudice in some of my psychology classes. And it takes a lot of gentle education to help people to see that we are all in this together as Americans. We have to have these conversations. We have no choice here. We're seeing people in the streets. We're seeing fist fights in the streets. We're seeing, you know, problems in all over, in cities and in rural areas, these confrontations. And if we don't talk about it, there will be more violence. We have no choice here.
Mm-hmm. So would addressing these head on and just going into these conversations overcome this feeling over a while? I guess I'm wondering, because some people, like, maybe they feel uncomfortable. They're like, I'm never going to go touch that topic again.
Yeah, right. Especially if one's had a bad experience, mm-hmm. Then one doesn't want to venture into those waters again, certainly. You know, workplaces are some of the places that are actually taking the lead here. And I find this interesting that in some cases, it's businesses that are taking the lead, corporations that are having not just diversity training and consciousness raising sessions, but actual education, this kind of gentle education that I mentioned. By professionals. Now, do we need professionals in order to get us as Americans to talk? That's sort of a controversial issue right there. Like, why shouldn't we be able to talk to each other without somebody who's trained in this, who's an actual expert? Well, I think corporations, again, as I said, are leading the way. I just read the other day that many corporations are hiring now chief diversity officers. CDOs are some of the hottest new positions because we've decided we can't leave this alone. That doesn't preclude you talking to a neighbor. That doesn't preclude, with an open heart and an open mind and a big smile on your face, approaching somebody and saying, you know, this is something I'm having a hard time understanding. I want to listen. But it really... where you really need to start with is, I want to listen, not I want to tell you what I think already. So it really requires an open mind and an ability of people to want to listen and to be prepared to confront viewpoints that are different from their own. And those can be painful. I mean, race is a painful historical topic in the United States. These are not easy conversations, and certainly people don't want to go into difficult conversations. I mean, we gravitate toward what's easy, right, rather than what's difficult. But I'm one of those people who really does believe this is essential for the future of this country to be able to do that. And one doesn't have to be a talk show host in order to, you know, in order to facilitate these conversations. I have been very moved by seeing people working together just in small neighborhood groups, small dialogue groups. Look at your local library once we can all gather again together. Local libraries often have discussion groups, reading groups. In my town here in South Bend, there's been some discussion groups and book groups reading about some of these issues. And I think that's remarkable when people come together with an open mind. One thing I think it is also important to acknowledge is it's not up to white people to approach people of color and say, I need you to teach me about your experience, because that's not actually the obligation of our friends and colleagues and neighbors and family members who are people of color. That's not their obligation. But we can certainly, as white folks, educate ourselves. There's lots of great material out there. And mm-hmm. lots of opportunities to make those connections.
Yeah. And I think it's important what you mentioned, the listening. I think for any conversations that we have, the listening part is really important. And it's so hard to be a good listener if you don't practice it. And so sometimes I think maybe people are speaking and they're telling their stories and they're sharing difficult conversations, but we're just kind of like waiting for our turn to have our statement, and we're not really paying attention.
Right. Yeah. The internet doesn't help much with that. And I'm not sure if you've noticed.
Yeah.
But yeah, right. Social media is very one-sided. Here's my, here's the photo of my, you know, beautiful dinner, beautiful child, beautiful dog. Here's my point of view. Here's my experience. Here's what I have come to think about. Here is my point of view and perspective. It's not dialogue engendering, right? Social media does not engender dialogues, regardless of how they were maybe intended at the outset. They're monologuers, right? Mm-hmm. If you're on social media, you're a monologuer. You want to talk about yourself. That's why you're there. You want to point and push your point of view. And it's also very, very easy to be pushed algorithmically into your own bubble on social media as well. Right. So you only ever hear and talk to and hear about perspectives that are similar to your own as well. And also we have really, I think, devolved into a social media existence over the last year because we have been isolated and distanced from one another. I really look forward to people getting back together and having conversations in person, face to face, where they have to relearn possibly how to talk and listen again. I think returning as an educator to the classroom this coming fall is going to be a really interesting experience that we're really going to have to kind of clamp down on the monologuing and to really encourage the dialoguing again, to get people to talk, not just talk, but to listen as well. And to do that, yeah.
I'm definitely going to start using this phrase monologuer. I'm just going to go and be like, you're a monologuer.
and we know who they are.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're having a discussion with Catherine Borschuk, professor of psychology at Indiana University South Bend, on difficult conversations. So we touched a bit about COVID and all of that, and I've been thinking a lot about how the pandemic has caused a lot of strife among friends, families, coworkers. It's like everyone has a line drawn in the sand about what they think is the right way to handle the CDC guidelines. But it's, as we've mentioned, it's a very touchy subject. How can you bring up your boundaries and what you're comfortable with if it's going to cause drama? Now it's just like you might avoid talking to somebody altogether because you're like, if I want to meet up with them, then I'm going to have to say, well, I only want to meet up outside, and then they're going to question me. And, you know, that's a whole nother...
Yeah, I've encountered this as well. You know, the Thursday night beer that we've been having on Zoom for the last year, we're very tentatively thinking, how do we get back together now that we're vaccinated? Or are we all mm-hmm. vaccinated for the Thursday night beer? How does that go? Yeah, so for sure, the way not to do it is to say, what I think is this, these are my list of conditions and demands, and I expect you to meet them all. And if you will not meet all of those conditions and demands, then, you know, you're dead to me, that kind of thing.
Oh, I got to change my approach.
Yeah, that's not the right approach. If that's what you're doing, Miriam, let's start with a new approach. Instead, I think what we want to do is start with, what are my concerns and why do I have these concerns? So, for instance, one of our Thursday night beer people might be a medically fragile person, maybe somebody with a lot of health conditions, maybe somebody who lives with their parents or is a caretaker for their grandparent and sees them an awful lot and is really concerned about contracting and passing along what we know to be a contagious virus. So starting with my position, my experience, that sort of thing helps to build trust. Now, you know,
oh, you unmuted.
I apologize.
No, sorry.
In fact, communication is interesting because it requires a level of trust. And we know from the study of social psychology, I always give a plug for my field, social psychology, is that reciprocity is essential for a dialogue. Reciprocity means that if I tell you something about me, nothing goes well until you tell me something about you. It really, for trust and a relationship to develop, I need to hear you talk about you just as I talk about myself. So if I divulge something and say, look, you know, I have been really depressed lately. Let's say I say that. And somebody says, oh, that's nice, Kath. Gotta go. Right. And they don't let me know how they're doing. Then there's a little bit of trust broken there. That's what we know.
Right.
That if I divulge something to you, I need some reciprocity. So if I just tell you my list of conditions and demands, what I'm going to get back is, well, here's my line in the sand. However, if I tell you what my concerns are, what I'm fearful about, what I worry about, what I'm trying to protect, what's important to me, what's happened to me, hopefully, if we have a relationship that's built on trust, then the reciprocity angle, the reciprocal angle will be saying, yeah, well, here's my concern. My concern is that I'm really haven't seen anybody for a year and I've been lonely and I'm worried about my mental health and blah, 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 right? However it goes. But there needs to be a give and take. And that goes back to the idea of listening as well as just monologuing, right? That you have to actually put something on the table and then prepare to see what comes back to you. It can't just be a one-way communication. And I think that's not a bad way to start. Of course, all the communication experts will tell you to start with the I statements. Right. I feel this, I feel that, right? We learned that a long, long time ago. And that's not bad, rather than saying you, I'm pointing my finger at you. And it's not just about COVID. There's all kinds of things that we don't want to discuss. You know, parents are worried about their kids going over to somebody's home because do they have guns in the house? So instead of starting with, you have a gun in your house, I think I don't want my 10-year-old in there. You could say my concerns are, right? Even mm-hmm. with racism and racial issues, you know, very often people will just say, my experience is this. My son was stopped by the police for no reason, or my sister-in-law finds that she doesn't, you know, blah, 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 these sorts of things. So starting with I or my experience or people around me, and this has led to my concerns, putting that on the table requires some reciprocity. And you know, if you have a trust-based relationship, if you start there.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that and that insight and that solution for all of our listeners who are thinking about getting their feet wet with some difficult conversations. Catherine Borschuk, Professor of Psychology, Indiana University, South Bend. Difficult Conversations Part 2 up next as we learn how these kinds of conversations take place in the workplace, how are HR departments having to tackle these issues, and why is it so hard for employees to speak up about things like asking for more money? That and more after the break. I'm Miriam Soh. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. When it comes to the workplace, it can be a difficult environment to navigate. Whether HR departments decide to make stronger policies about training employees to be anti-racist or for employees to feel comfortable going to the HR department in the first place. Our next guest is an expert in the world of human resources. And as scared as I feel talking to someone from HR, we're going to get to the bottom of this fear and figure out why there's so much apprehension when it comes to this particular department. I'd like to welcome Carolyn Gerner to the show, Aldi Incorporated Distinguished ICOR Clinical Professor of Management in the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University, Bloomington. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's delightful to be with you. And I promise it's not like the principal's office, really. HR is not that scary. We can debunk this.
Well, why is there so much fear and anxiety wrapped up in us when we hear the word HR or human resources?
Well, I think it is a little bit like the principal's office, if I'm going to be really honest. That's the place where they have your permanent record. And that's mm-hmm. the place where if there's punishment to be doled out, they're going to dole it out. It's also, frankly, HR is very often sort of the compliance arm. So if you do something wrong, they're going to come down on you. You'll often hear people say, don't tell HR when they say something they think might be funny. So on the one hand, you've definitely got this sense of policing the organization, if you will, to make sure that things are done right. On the other hand, there's also a sense of this is where they maintain all the information about my performance. And this is where they know everything about me. And if I go in there, there's an imbalance of power, if you will. Right. I almost feel like I'm walking in and, you know, and then heaven forbid, they try to explain a pension plan to me or something that will not be in simple language. And so there's a lot of things that just inherently make the conversation tough. Both from there's technical things being explained, there's a sense of things having to be said correctly. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that gets in the way of really having open conversation.
Is there a stereotype about this department in companies that, you know, we kind of mentioned this, but like there's this saying, you never want to hear from them after you're hired. Like as long as you don't have anything to do with them, you'll be fine.
That is absolutely the case, especially in those companies where HR is that compliance officer. Now, the companies that are doing it right, HR is a part of the fabric of what they do. They show up for making sure that everyone has a good talent development plan. They make sure that you know where your next promotion is coming from and what you need to do. They're really a part of the fabric of the organization. But unfortunately, that's not the majority. And so most organizations wind up with an HR department that is seen as a place where they're kind of isolated, they're full of shoulds, and they just aren't really even part of the fabric or culture. It's not unusual for people who work in HR to sometimes feel like they don't know people in the rest of the company. It can be pretty isolating from that standpoint, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if some HR professionals just would never know their employees unless something big happened.
It's unfortunately, that's often the case. And something big is often something negative. So I'll know you if you have a special benefits event, or I'll know you if there is a performance issue, or I'll know you if you need a leave of absence. And so oftentimes that's that's really the context. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
Is it fair for HR departments to somehow now be in charge of all kinds of trainings for employees, from anti-racism to sexual harassment policies? Are they equipped for these kinds of topics?
Well, technically, yes. If I'm going to say that we've got people who have taken the classes and gotten the certifications and know how to manage crucial conversations, et cetera, yes. These are some of the most educated individuals within most organizations when it comes to those procedures. But where I think there can be a disconnect is in teaching people how to go back and transfer what they learn into their actual work environment. So I could have a conversation with you that said, be aware of your inner biases and be aware of your unconscious bias and understand the ways that you are, approaching people and do that with dignity and respect. Mm-hmm. We would all agree that that's a really good thing. But if I don't talk to you about how to have a good fight in your work team and how to disagree with people constructively, or if I don't talk to you about how to ask good questions of the people on your team to try to figure out how to create psychological safety, I haven't done it right. And so I think that's where the disconnect happens. All of the information they're going to give you is technically correct, but the transfer from one place to another becomes a problem.
And so that's interesting that the HR department can facilitate and help employees learn how to better have conversations with one another. When it comes to anti-racism training, we're seeing the tide shift and more companies getting on board with something that's long overdue. How has the discussion among HR professionals addressed how to make that something that continues and is part of the fabric of companies and organizations and not merely part of a trend?
Well, I love the way that you just said continues and becomes part of the fabric, because frankly, Marin, that's why it has to happen. One of the things we know about inclusion is that it isn't enough just to have people who don't look the same. That's diversity. Mm-hmm. But inclusion is an ongoing process. It's an ongoing conversation. And I think what we finally have realized, and this of course flies in the face of a lot of educators like myself, is that there's not a check the box, you've learned this now moment. Instead, what we have to do is teach you how to continue to explore and how to continue have conversations and how to bounce back when you get it wrong, because you will. Yeah. And that's a different kind of training. It's more comfort with the process than it is, all right, you've learned this and you have these competencies.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the earlier segment, we talked about difficult conversations among people, friends, family members, coworkers. But when it comes specifically to the workplace, why is it so hard to have discussions over these kinds of topics? And how can folks be better equipped in the workplace? Is that HR's job, or is that each individual has to kind of do their homework too?
Really, I think both. And so the reason it's so hard, first of all, is that there really is a power imbalance. I mean, with my friend or with my family, there's generally a sense of, I know you, I can talk to you. Excuse me. And there's limitations to what might happen to me as a consequence. On the other hand, if I go into my employment, that's the place that puts a roof over my head and feeds my kids. And so there's a power imbalance there that can very often take all of those regular communication dynamics and make them really difficult. So Dr. Porchak is exactly right. I would expect reciprocity in a conversation that I had with someone who's a friend or a family member. I would not necessarily expect that same reciprocity from my boss. And there's a power imbalance there that makes that something that if it happened and we had that relationship, terrific, but that's not something that I would count on as I went in. And so those dependencies really make us less vulnerable, or make us more vulnerable rather. And then the other piece of it is, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm always doing impression management at work. I think we all are, in terms of trying to present our best selves as someone that you want to promote, someone that you want to put on the next project or show to a customer or let do all the cool things. And so because we're constantly working on making ourselves look as professional, and you can't see my air quotes, but I'm using them as we can, there's a sense of, well, I don't want to do anything that might tarnish that image. I don't want to do anything that might make them doubtful when my name comes up for the next opportunity. So that tension is playing in there as well. Mm-hmm. Now, all that being said, what I primarily teach is negotiation. Of course, the number one question is always, what do I do if I want more money? How do I have that conversation? Because it is one of the tougher ones to have. So if you don't mind, I'm going to use that as an example, but yeah, it really will have, I think, some application to other stuff as well. So on the one hand, does it start with me? Yeah. I need to go do my homework. I need to have a really good understanding of what the salary surveys say that I should be earning. I need to know my job description really well. I need to have a real sense of what skills I have and what those are worth in the workforce. So I need to spend some time on Glassdoor or some salary surveys to really get a sense of what that's all about. And I also need a reason that I am contributing more to the organization than I'm being compensated for. Now, that both of those are really important, and people often take the second one as a given. Well, I'm talented, give me more money. Well, yeah, I'm a pretty darn good cook, but that doesn't make me a better professor. So given that, I can't really go in and say, well, I just finished a culinary class, give me more money. It's got to be relevant to the organization. It's got to be something that adds value for them. And it's really about the individual explaining that. So if I come in and say, I just got certified in, I don't know, crucial conversations, why is that helpful to my workplace? What value does that add? Because I am an investment, and my salary is an investment in me that the company is making. And I don't mean to sound crass, but they're expecting a return. Yeah. And so I need to explain to them why investing more in me will have a better return for them. Mm-hmm. So that same thing starts to now segue into, well, how do I talk about the fact that I may not be ready to come back to the workplace? Or how may I talk about the fact that I want to continue to work from home a little bit, or that I may need some time off to continue to care for someone who's recovering, or whatever that might be. Excuse me. And that very first question really is, I've got to do my homework. I've got to know exactly what I'm asking for. I've got to know what I want. I've got to know what's reasonable. And I have to know my work team well enough to know what's reasonable to ask for. Mm-hmm. And know kind of how I contribute value to the company and from where can I do that. Right. Also need to know the company and their values.
Right.
And then
right.
From there, I can start to say, all right, now what can we work out? I understand your perspective. What can we do? Mm-hmm.
So can we bring you in as like the person to speak on our behalf?
I can't do it for you, but I can certainly be in your corner. In fact, coaching people for salary negotiations is probably more fun than I should be allowed to have.
Right. Well, if you're listening and you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Carolyn Gerner, Aldi, Inc., Distinguished ICOR Clinical Professor of Management in the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University, Bloomington, talking about the workplace, difficult conversations, HR, all of that good stuff. You know, I'm wondering, when it comes to the pandemic in the workplace, you touched on that a little bit, folks are apprehensive about sharing their comfort level. Are HR departments looking into what could potentially become a conflict in the future where some people may want proof that their coworkers are vaccinated?
Absolutely. And this kind of began even before before everything came to a head. You were seeing Wall Street Journal articles about fights breaking out in workplaces over how much Lysol people were spraying at their desks. So this is absolutely something that we know when it comes to shared space. We're uncomfortable about that when it comes to having, you know, beers on a Thursday, as Dr. Borsuk said. But boy, when I have to sit next to you now for 7 or 8 hours a day and you're breathing in my space, suddenly that becomes a whole nother arena. So one of the things that we've really seen HR in particular and the companies that are doing it right, kind of making sure that they do, is providing the protection for people, but not really getting in the way of mandating what happens. And some folks are saying that they need to go far enough and say everyone will come back and be vaccinated or whatever that might be. And certainly depending on the organization and how much, say, interaction with the public they have, you know, whether they're frontline service workers, those kinds of things, completely understand it. But for a more typical, say, private financial services company, what happens? So usually HR will err on the side of saying we need people to be safe. And people may find that that is maybe more restrictive than they wished. They may still be sitting 6 feet apart in meetings or however that played out. But fundamentally, the philosophy is we're going to protect first and then worry about relaxing those restrictions as we move forward. Companies have some really tough choices to make right now with regard to what they're going to mandate. So do we mandate vaccinations? What does that mean if we do? Mm-hmm. What does that do for our workforce? I literally just found out today that IU is going to mandate the vaccine for students who are coming back in the fall. And I really have two feelings about that. On the one hand, great, we'll be protected. We have a less of a chance of illness. But on the other hand, does that mean people have are you really vaccinated? Was that a fake COVID card, like your fake ID? Right. I mean, what is this, right? And so I am, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Most of the time when companies are doing this, though, they're going to do this with a certain amount of protection of privacy, certainly, particularly as it comes down to health issues. They'll protect the information about employees' health as closely and directly as they can. But they also are going to have to think about the general workplace safety. And so if it's anything like what we see for safety standards in manufacturing, for example, there will be a lot of procedures and a lot of things that have to be followed and a lot of routines and rituals that need to become part of the workplace. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is where we're really going to see folks step in as those become part of the job description and part of the day-to-day routine of what people are doing.
Right. I wonder if it becomes too much more process, if it would be easier for some companies just to keep their employees home.
That seems to be what we're seeing. Most folks have not made formal decisions yet. Those are kind of cropping up. But we certainly are seeing many companies report that at least some of their workers will work remotely at least some of the time. Mm-hmm. In fact, the folks who say we're going to bring everybody back just the same way it was before, who aren't in, say, manufacturing where you kind of have to, that's only about 10 to 15% of companies right now. And so the vast majority will find themselves being a lot more flexible, at least based on the current research.
Right. I think for a lot of the younger folks who've been pushing for remote work in the tech companies and all that are just like, yeah, we told you it could be done. You see, it can be done.
Well, old part is good news about this is that those of us who may have grown up with, having your face in the office is the way to get ahead.
Right.
I've really learned that it's about getting things done, not about being physically there.
Right. You can be the best monologuer, but you got to get your work done.
Amen. Yes.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, are there any topics that you think should be completely off limits in the workplace, or is everything fair game as long as we know how to talk about it?
Well, I think that there are things that we probably shouldn't have discussions about with regard to, say, what we're doing sexually, what we are particularly engaging in that might have criminal implications. And I'm not really saying that with too much of a smile on my face. Polite conversation is still polite conversation. And I think the key is keeping the topics that are going to keep everyone comfortable. Lee Hamilton, a longtime IU congressman, said that his definition of leadership is making everyone in the room comfortable. And that's something that you don't have to agree with him, but I want everybody to be comfortable enough to have a conversation. And that to me has always just been outstanding advice.
Wonderful. And I really enjoyed your insight today. And thank you so much for being on the program. Carolyn Gurner-Aldi, Inc., Distinguished ICOR Clinical Professor of Management in the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University Bloomington. Our producer is Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you want to listen to this or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us on Monday when we take a look at where Indiana is headed when it comes to COVID-19 herd immunity. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.